Accession number 9552, Reel 21.
Basil Farrow, Reel 21. Could you tell me what happened after your wife and child arrived at Le Mans?
Well, I got them fixed up in a lodging, if you like, with a civilian, and carried on. It might have lasted, I've forgotten how long. She arrived on the 28th of May. She arrived on the 28th of May. So, within the 10 days. Oh, incidentally, I ought to mention at this headquarters there were half a dozen or so ATS girls, and I heard that they were being evacuated on that particular, and the particular day. I heard that they were being evacuated, so I went along. They had an ATS officer, and I saw the ATS officer, a lieutenant, and I told her, I said, I've got my wife and boy in this town. I understand that you'll be leaving this afternoon. Could you take them with you? Can they join you? And I remember her saying she would be only too glad to, but she hadn't the authority to anything like that. She couldn't do that. And so I went along to the HQ, and I saw the various officers, majors, colonels, and they said it was impossible, because in the first place they were couldn't take civilians on either road transport or rail, particularly not on rail. If the French were allowing them a limited number of rail transport things, trains, for military purposes only, but not for the evacuation of, certainly not for the evacuation of civilians. They wouldn't allow it, and we couldn't take her on a lorry because there's so many civilians on the road. And anyhow, I think it was the general happened to walk in during this discussion. What's it all about? And they told him the sergeant's wife and boy is here, and he's asking us to take if his wife and with her boy can go out with the ATS. So the general said, of course it can, and they pointed out to the general the difficulties. Oh well, if it's necessary, they can just give them military greatcoats. He said, no, make out, and my son still has the official order of transport for the son, for the wife and daughter of sergeant number 2187502, Sergeant B. Farrer. And I saw them off. They went, to get out of Le Mans to the sidings, because Le Mans was enclosed, you had to have permission to get out and get in from the Prevost. We've got that pass. And I saw them off. There was just one carriage, and the others were wagons for the troops, and a carriage for the officers and the ATS. And I saw them off. On the 18th, no, the on the 12th, on the 12th of June, they'd arrived on the 28th of May. That's when they'd arrived in Le Mans, and they left on the 12th of June. They left on the 12th of June. Incidentally, I'll just a rather extraordinary coincidence. What? During that period in Le Mans, amongst the ATS girls, I happened to ask one of them, and I had occasion to ask one of them her name, and she said Anne. I said, yes, but what's your full name, your surname? She said Anne Massey, and it sort of involved an exclamation on my part. I said, how strange. She said, what's strange about my name, Sergeant? Well, I said, I beg your pardon, it's nothing strange. I said, it's merely a coincidence. I said, Anne Massey, I said, it just happens, I do know it was the maiden name of my mother-in-law. I said, but I don't think you'd be related. I said, because I know that my mother-in-law was born in Madras, India. She said, so was my father. So, there must have been some connection. I said, well, you'll see, this was before my wife had arrived in Le Mans, and I was waiting for her. I said, well, with a bit of luck, you'll meet your aunt. And my wife left with him, but we never... After my wife arrived in England, she made for Nottingham, and we don't know what became of Anne Massey. But that's just, by the way, an extraordinary coincidence. Yeah, I think it was worth telling. Anyhow, my wife, as I say, she left on the 18th. And no, on the when was it now? On the 12th. On the 12th of June. Now, on the 16th, and I think it was a Saturday, we stood to about 4 o'clock in the morning. We'd ordered to stand to, and we moved off. But not by train, by road. On a lorry, army lorry. Down we went. I didn't know where we were going, but we eventually arrived at St Malo. And bivouacked on the racecourse. And by bush telegraph, as it's known, I found out that very day, I got it, somebody passed it on to me, that the Lancaster had been sunk at Saint-Nazaire with a great loss of life. Now, that worried me considerably, because Saint-Nazaire's on Le Mans, not Saint-Nazaire. And I thought the train would have made for Saint-Nazaire. Lancaster was a Cunard boat, and naive, it was really naive of me to think so, my wife would naturally get on board a Cunard boat. Anyhow, I was very ups, very worried. So much so, anyhow, we left St Malo on the, I think it was on the night of the 7th, between the night of the 17th and 18th of June, as you see, sometime after Dunkirk. And I remember the conversation when I was on, it was a little coaster, there was about a dozen of us, we were probably the last dozen to leave St Malo, who must have been, because the night of the 18th and 19th, and France had actually officially asked for the armistice on the 20th, so we got out just in time. And it was only a little coaster with just the one deck and the bottom part, you know. We were down there, and a chaplain remarked, I was looking very gloomy, he said, "What's the matter, Sergeant, don't you think we'll make it?" He thought I'd got the wind up. I said, "No, I said, I'm not worried about myself. I said, I'm thinking about my wife and boy." He said, "Why, what about them?" I said, "Well, I left Le Mans at a certain date, 3 days before I left, I saw my wife and boy off with from Le Mans, and I'm wondering whether they were on the Lancaster, which I've heard has gone down with great loss of life." Well, he said, "Your wife and boy?" He said, "Well, I was on, where was it? Some station." He named it. He said, "And troop train came in, and there was a carriage with some HES girls, and there was a civilian and a boy dressed up as a scout." I said, "That was my wife, and that was my boy. He was a French, English-French scout." I said, "What happened to him?" He said, "I don't know. There was an air raid on at the time, and I don't know what happened, whether they went out or what. But..." So he couldn't tell me, but he'd seen them, obviously. And it took us quite a time. We went right out to sea. We arrived in Southampton, and we switched over to Bournemouth straight away, and then transported to a school on the outskirts of Bournemouth, given something, a wash and a change, and brush up and all that kind of thing, something to eat and drink, until we were free for the afternoon. So I went down into Bournemouth, went to post office, the general post office there, and asked to put in a call for Nottingham. And there were so many calls on the line, I was told to come back in a couple of hours' time, which I did. And I got through in 2 hours' time, got through to Nottingham, and it was found that my wife and boy had made it. They'd come out of St Malo too, they hadn't come to St there. So they'd come out of St Malo the same time, the same way as I had, but previously. Anyhow, we're at Bournemouth, and after various peregrinations moving about, because obviously I'd been specially enlisted for special duties, I was in a corps where it was not the ordinary infantry, the engineers, they were all tradesmen and all specialists of a kind. I wasn't even a sapper, so I was a spare fire, but my rank had become what they call war substantive. That is to say, if you held rank, the rule was then, at that time with this general, that if you held the rank for 6 months whilst in active service there, your rank became substantive rank. You couldn't be reduced. You held that rank. Had I not completed the 6 months, there's no doubt when I got to the depot, which I eventually did at Chatham, I'd have been reduced to the rank of a sapper. Sapper's equivalent of private in the infantry. But I was a war substantive sergeant, and not even trained as a sapper, so they couldn't employ me. And I had a rather miserable time. And one day I received the visit of a chap from the War Office. It was a Major Cauldron, and it was a chap whom I happened to know, who was a neighbour of mine in Garche, this suburb of Paris. I knew him when he was a schoolboy. When he was at college, he used to go into Paris every day to a lycée called the Lycée Condorcet, one of the big lycées in Paris. I knew him then, but he turned up as a major. And of course, he asked me where I'd like to, what part of England I'd like to do. Well, my wife and boy in Nottingham. I said, well, if possible, Nottingham. So he said, well, you know, yes, Disney's there. You know Disney, don't you? I said, who's Disney? He said, well, Colin Disney. I said, well, no, I don't know him. He said, well, he's lived in Paris before, in Calais before the war. Oh, I said, I didn't know many people in Calais. I certainly didn't know Disney. Isn't he now? He said, he's quartering commandant for Nottingham, the counties of Nottinghamshire and Derby, and he's located in Nottingham. His personnel are all civilians, himself and an assistant in uniform. He said, I can send you up as an additional assistant. He'd be glad to have you. So I was posted to Nottingham, here in the park there. And that went on for...
Before we go on to there, just one question I perhaps should have asked earlier. While you were getting out of France, was there much evidence of the Germans? Were there many air raids, or was there much...
Well, I didn't... there was a lot of... lot of alerts, but I didn't experience an air raid whilst I was there during that period. Neither at Rouen, the alert was going continually, daily, practically. I mean, almost hourly. But I didn't experience an air raid. Nor did I at Le Mans. Nor did I at Saint Malo when we were coming out. Well, the alerts, yes, but I personally didn't experience.
The Germans were an unseen threat.
Yes, as far as I was concerned. Okay. They were on our tail, if you like.
So, now you reported to Hardwick House, the park.
That's right.
Disney on the 25th of August, 1940.
Yes, that's right.
Now, could you tell me what exactly... You were there then for most of the war, I believe.
Well, I was there until towards the end of 1943.
Could you tell me what exactly your duties were there? What exactly you had to do? In as much detail as you can remember, as this assistant.
Well, I was more or less supervising, in charge of the office. There was a couple of sappers too, and I was sort of in charge of them. They would go out on reconnaissance, and I would go out too sometimes to find accommodation. We'd have instructions that accommodation was required for a certain number. Either in Nottingham, for instance, we requisitioned quite a lot of property in Nottingham because the ATS postal service was stationed here, and therefore there was a lot of ATS. And at West Bridgeford, you don't know Nottingham, but West Bridgeford was Worcester's Road, practically the old road. And if we heard of a house being empty, we'd dash along, and here we could requisition. As I said, in France we'd no powers, but in England we had powers of requisition. And I'd travel, and sometimes with the officer. Would travel around the county. I remember us going to Osbert Sitwell's place up in North Derbyshire there, and being received very, very nice and entertained by Osbert Sitwell. And he said that he could put a couple of officers up in his place. It was a magnificent place he had. He said, but with regard to troops, he said, but he'd got a private golf course. He said, I can let you have the 19th hole for W.O. and Sergeant's mess. And we went along to the 19th hole, and he'd got stocks there, so we had a drink there. jobs like that. Now, there's one or two things during that period. I remember in the First World War, I was a bit foolish. I used to volunteer and jump out of the frying pan into fire and things like that, naively. I was a bit like that in the Second World War. I felt that I wasn't doing a job. I had the feeling that I wasn't doing the proper job there. That I'd been enlisted because I spoke French as well as I speak English. I could then. I still speak it, but I've been retired now 25 years and I don't often have occasion, but nevertheless, I remember it very well. And it couldn't be used, but I knew there were jobs over in France, so I volunteered for one or two things. Now, there was one, what they call an Army Council instruction. We used to get the copies of them, and they were calling for linguists, and I replied, and transferring to the intelligence corps. Now, I used to write letters official letters and put them in front of the colonel. He'd sign them very often without reading them. He really relied on me, you know. And this went through. The reply came back for calling me to London for an interview. He got the reply before passing the stuff to him. He said, "What's this, Sergeant?" I said, "It's the application we made." I said, "What do you mean we made?" I said, "Well, you signed it." He said, "Of course I signed what you give me, but..." He said, you'd get me to sign that. One of these days you'll get me to sign my own death warrant. What's this?" I said, "Well, I made application, sir, to be transferred to the Intelligence Corps for special duties." Have I done anything now?
No, it's
all right. He said, "But what's your idea?" I said, "Well, sir, I feel I could do something different to what I'm doing here. I'm qualified for it." He said, "But aren't you living with... isn't your wife and family living here?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Why, have you had some trouble at home?" I said, "No." He said, "Does your wife know of this?" I said, "Well, of course, you'll have to know." He said, "Now, look here, Sergeant." He was, incidentally, he was a major at the time, with the MC of the First World War. He said, "We did our job in the First World War. The jobs we're doing now are for us. We're too old for what we did in those days." He said, "But if you're really insistent," he said, "I've got to recommend whether you an NCO or an officer. I'll recommend you then, and for a commission." He said, "But believe me," he said, "you'll be trained. The training may last 2, 3, or 4 months. And then you'll be dropped over there, and you'll last two or three weeks if you're lucky." And he talked me out of it, so I didn't. I said, "But now this is I do remember these words." I said, "Well, after all, sir," I said, "I can't back out now." He said, "What do you mean you can't back out?" I said, "I've made application in principle. I can't." He said, "Sergeant," he said, "you mean to tell me you've got principles?" Now, those were his exact words. I said, "Well, I can't write back." He said, "Well, I will." And that was a thing that I'd... Anyhow, 1943 came along, and I did want to be...
While you were doing your billeting duties and finding fields and things for the army, did you have any problem in this country with people being reluctant or willing?
Oh, yes. Occasionally we did. Others... some were rather reluctant. Some were.
Did they explain why?
No, for instance, I do remember a case in Nottingham. It was in a residential place, and the people next door saw me coming down the garden, and they guessed, and they came along. "You're not putting troops in here?" I said, "Why do you ask, madam?" She said, "But no, we can't have..." And I said, "Have you got anybody in the services?" I said, "The winter's coming along. Would you rather them sleep out in the open or in an empty house?" Anyhow, they were very averse to... But I knew I was requisitioned this place for the ATS. But that was the kind of... We did have some reluctance. I remember once I was with the colonel, with my Colonel Wood. This was the chap who asked me if I'd got principles, you know. We were out in the country, and we went to a country house, and the lady came, and she was very indignant. He was looking for accommodation. We had troops moving in, and she said, "I shall be writing to my husband. He's in Egypt, brigadier, and he'll hear about this." That was a reception we got from the lady of a brigadier, but it wasn't general. But that was we did have one or two objections.
Was there any problem once you'd got the people in billets with the troops not behaving, or with just resentment creeping in?
If there were, that didn't concern us. We were merely concerned in getting the accommodation. Then any difference with troops and surroundings, well, that would be a matter for regimental and brigade and all that. The troops.
Would you arrange for the people who provided the billets to be paid, or for a food allowance to be paid? Would you arrange that?
We didn't arrange the payments.
You just found.
We just found the place and arranged the requisition, plunked the requisition and had it there. And then, of course, on our records, that would be a permanent place for troops or whatever need we wanted. with ground and stuff like that. And I remember there was one property we could never requisition. We hadn't the powers of requisition. We hadn't the powers of requisition in miners' institutes. Now, they would have been very useful, the miners' institute, but we hadn't the power of requisition. We had to leave them alone. They came under the Ministry of Works for some reason or other. And the military couldn't touch them. So that was that. Anyhow, as 1943 was coming to an end, I think it was generally expected in England that the invasion would be coming along, because the country was full of American troops and all that. And of course, if you were in the south, you'd probably see that. But we were in Nottingham, so we didn't know what was happening down south and all other places. But it was sort of generally thought that the invasion was getting near, and I wanted to be in the invasion. So, much against Colonel Wood's wishes, I got myself returned to my regiment. Asked to be returned to my regiment, that is to say, because as I was what they call extra regimentally employed. So I was returned, and the depot of the REs had been moved. The depot in Kitchener Barracks had been bombed and destroyed, and they'd moved to Halifax, D Company REs depot, Halifax. I reported there, and there again I was a spare file. A sergeant, I mean, he's there in charge of troops, and he's a qualified man, a sergeant in the REs. I had no qualifications except my French. That was my own qualification. So I wasn't qualified as a sergeant in the REs, as an RE.
What did your wife think of this move you'd made? Because I presume you'd left her behind in Nottingham.
Yeah, left her behind in Nottingham. I don't know, really. I don't think I asked her. I suppose she took it for granted.
So you went there in January 44?
No, December. December 43. Because I remember getting leave, the Christmas leave, to come and join in Nottingham. Went back. And it went on, but during the period before the invasion, again, I had this bug. Because I was wasting my time there, and it's very monotonous when you're not doing anything. In fact, it took me all my time, you might say, to dodge the column. I mean, like, to keep out of the way, you see. Then, I could have been trained for something then. As it transpires, something. I could have been trained for something. Anyhow, I heard of something. I don't know how I got it, but I got an interview in London. I was called down to London to War Office. I remember that. I think it was room 404. Room 404 it was, if I remember rightly. And I was interviewed by a Major Eric. That was the previous interview. This was a colonel, a different colonel at the 20th Military Mission in London. I was interviewed there for a special job. His job was really to my linguistic, and he sort of spoke per French and all that.
What was the special job going to be?
I think it was Madagascar. Madagascar, because we invaded Madagascar before there.
As an interpreter.
Attached with the French, you see, because it was a French thing, so I'd be attached to a unit, and they'd want somebody to this connection. And then he said, "Oh, by the way, what's your medical category?" "Oh," I said, "C3, sir." "Oh," I said, "you're out." He said, "Can't send a C3 man to Madagascar." I don't think he said to Madagascar. He said, "On this job, no, sorry." That's the end of it. I returned to Halifax. Next day I reported sick. Saw the MO. MO said, "What do you want? What's the matter with you?" I said, "Nothing, sir. I want my medical category raised." He said, "What do you mean?" I mean, nobody had never been asked to do that before. To lower it, yes. And I explained. He said, "Well, how come you're C3 anyhow?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "Maybe my age. And of course, from my pre-war records, my First World War records, I don't know, I was wounded and all that." Anyhow, without further ado, he raised me to A1. Of course, that's notified, your medical thing's notified to records, RE records, straight away, your category. So I was available then for posting. And blow me, if I wasn't, within a week I'd got a posting to a field company. Well, I wasn't trained for, as I say, I wasn't trained as a sapper. And a sergeant going to a field company is a qualified man. I immediately saw asked for an interview with the officer commanding the depot at Halifax, and explained the situation to him. He was quite understood. He appreciated my situation, and he wrote to records and told them that I wasn't qualified and for this kind of work. I'd been specially enlisted for special duties, extra regimental duties. I wasn't technically qualified as an RE, but I was an RE sergeant nevertheless. But that was squashed. The invasion came, and I used to, as I say, try and find myself jobs, and very often I'd go along to the orderly room and ask the orderly room sergeant if I could help in there to pass the time. And I remember one Saturday, this was after the invasion, 2 or 3 weeks after, probably within a week or so of the invasion, I'd forgotten the precise date, it was shortly after the date of the invasion, you know. I was in the orderly room alone on a Saturday afternoon, and the telephone rang. This is an extraordinary coincidence too, I should be there. I picked it up, I said hello. It was the War Office, London. They said that's D Company REs, Halifax. Yes, sir. You've got a Sergeant Farrer there. I said, yes, Sergeant Farrer speaking, sir. Oh, well, report here on Monday or Tuesday, whatever it was. Report here. With kitted out for active service. Oh, I said, but will you confirm that, sir? Because I I can't tell the colonel that I've got a telephone message to report to London. Will you confirm it, all right? And down I went to London. I found I was posted to what they call the interpreter's pool. I reported to the Great Central Station, that was the London Assembly Centre, where all what they call these, the odds and sods, SOEs and all that, used to report there before sending over to France. I reported there. And I was there in 2 or 3 weeks. Anyhow, then, one day, I was sent. The officer said to me, he said, oh, by the way, the officer in charge, he said, did you ride a motorbike, Sergeant? I said, no. He said, right, report to Kensington Barracks tomorrow morning. And I reported. And there was a corporal there in charge of transport at Kensington Barracks. Oh, he said, yes, I've had a telephone call. I've got to teach to ride a motorcycle. And there was a row of big army motorcycles there. He said, take that one, Sergeant. This was corporal giving me an order, so I took it. It was a whopping bit like a young tank, you know. And of course, I'm not a young man now, you know. This is in 44, I'm 47 years of age. I pushed it through the barracks, and we came out at the end, and behind the...